I hope you understand that we just joined in with 3,000 years of faithful believers in singing the words of Psalm 24. Lord, give us clean hands and a pure heart. Let us not lift our souls to another. Thank you for leading us in worship already today. Let's go to the throne. Father, we thank you for this time, and we know, Lord, that you take it very, very seriously. That our worship of you is central to who we are and what we're created to be. And we want to join into it today the way you want us to, with clean hands and a pure heart. Father, I pray that today, that even now, that you would help us to see Jesus, that he would be lifted up, and that we would worship together in a way that brings joy to your heart today. I pray it in Jesus' name. Last Monday morning, I received an email from Becky Hayes. I now read it with her permission. She says, "Dear Chris, I want to thank you for your message yesterday. It was such a blessing and encouragement to me. I also want to share that I was able to use some of what you said in my life not 15 minutes after the morning service was over." Those are, it's music to the preacher's ear. "As my daughters and I were driving to Fairborn to meet friends for lunch, we were listening to my favorite radio station. The station went to a news break, and one of my daughters asked the other daughter to change the station to one with some music. I protested briefly that this was my favorite station, and a little news wouldn't hurt anyone. The station was changed, however. That's when I remembered your words from the service, and I said, 'Excuse me, but I own this car.' I pay for the upkeep on this car. I pay for the insurance in this car. I put gas in it. I am the adult. You are the child. Exactly why are we having this conversation?" The station was changed back to the one I prefer. I was feeling rather proud of the stand that I took, and that's when my other daughter quietly said from the back of the car, "Mom, remember the point of that illustration. God doesn't say that to us. He gives us a choice." Oh, man, what's going to happen if kids really start listening to this service? We're going to be in trouble. Bethany, or Sarah, I don't know. Congratulations, girls, for listening carefully. You never know when the sermon's going to come in handy. You ought to listen carefully. It's an amazing thought. I suppose about last week's sermon, that's the thing that amazes me most, is that God gives us that choice. The very first command is that you shall have no other gods before me. It is the fundamental command. That God is at the center of the universe, and if you don't put him at the center of your universe, your life will be absolutely out of control. Such an important decision, and I would think if I were God, it's so important, I would make sure that no one messed it up, and I'd make it for us. But God doesn't do this. He lets us make that decision. So if you put God at first place, and there are no other gods before me, it's just natural, then, that you would want to come to authentic worship. And that's what the second one is all about. You shall not have any more idols in front of me. The text says something like, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt." Out of the land of slavery, that's why, number one, you shall have no other gods before me. The second command is, you shall not make for yourselves idols in the form of anything in the heavens above or on the earth below or in the waters beneath. You shall not worship them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands who love me and keep my commandments." It's an interesting command. You notice right away that it's much longer than either the first one or the third one. It says a lot about children. Children are very important in this command. Sometimes it seems just a little bit unfair because it says children are punished for sins of the father. What's that all about? And you might be tempted to dismiss it because you say, well, we don't have any trouble with figurines. We're not bowing down to idols, so we're okay. But remember, the goal of this passage, the goal of the commands, the goal of the law is that we might learn something about God. As you read these commands, you learn something about the nature of the God whom we serve. And beyond that, one of the very last verses in the New Testament, 1 John chapter 5, it's not chronologically, but I mean, it is chronologically. It's one of the very last verses ever written. It says, little children, keep yourselves from idols. So these verses bear a lot of inspection on our part. Again, A.W. Tozer said this, let us beware in our pride that we accept the erroneous notion that idolatry consists only in kneeling before visible objects of adoration, and that civilized peoples are therefore free from it. The essence of idolatry is the entertainment of thoughts about God that are unworthy of Him. It begins in the mind and may be present where no overt act of worship has taken place. So let's not be guilty of idolatry. Let's think some high thoughts about God today. As we look at this verse, it just kind of logically breaks down into three different sections for me. First of all, I can think about some logical reasons for this command. Then I can think about some historical reasons for the command. And then finally, I want to talk about some personal reasons for this command. So let's talk about the first one first here, the logical reasons for the command. The reason why God says you can't serve idols is basically you can't put a transcendent God in a box. God knows what He's talking about, of course, because when He speaks these commands to the children of Israel for the first time, what happens next is Moses goes up the mountain so he can write the commands on the tablets of stone. Sure enough, before he gets back, Aaron has messed up and the people have messed up. They say, we want a God that we can see and we can touch and we can feel. So Aaron gets their gold and forms it into an idol. And then he says, let's celebrate a festival to Yahweh. So evidently he's trying to say, let's think about Yahweh in terms of this idol. It was a bad idea. In fact, the text is not really very comforting to him because it says, Aaron formed the idol. He yasard the idol in Hebrew. And if you're looking at this in Hebrew, there's an instant connection between that and Genesis 2:7 because that's where it says God formed man out of the dust. You see the irony here? God forms man out of the dust, and now the dust, man, has tried to form God. I don't think John MacArthur was the first one to say it, but he's the one I heard it from. He said, God created man in His own image, and man's been trying to return the favor ever since. A number of good reasons why that's a really dumb thing to do, why you wouldn't want to make an idol. And the first one is probably simply the depth and the mystery of a transcendent being. You just can't put all of God in a box. He's incomprehensible. You and I are never going to fully understand Him. He's infinite. You and I can't exhaust Him. He is uncontrollable. We can't control Him. One of my favorite passages is here in Daniel chapter 4. Let me read it to you. Nebuchadnezzar says, for this rule is an everlasting rule. His rule is. And His kingdom extends from one generation to the next. All the inhabitants of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as He wishes with the army of heaven. And with those who inhabit the earth, no one slaps His hand and says to Him, what have you done? He's uncontrollable, unmanageable. You take a look again back here in the Old Testament, and just after Aaron made that calf, Moses comes down and cleans up the mess, and he goes back up the mountain, and Moses says, God, they wanted to see You and touch You, and I understand that a little bit. I want to see Your glory. And God says to him, Moses, you can't take My glory. But here's what I'll do. Here's what I'll do for you. We'll find a huge boulder that has a crack in it, and we will hide you in the crack of that boulder. And I will walk by, and I'll put My hand over the crack as I walk by. And then as I'm leaving, I'll take My hand off, and you can just sort of see just the glimpses of the backside of My glory. Because otherwise you couldn't take it. You would melt. You cannot take who I am. In the book of Revelation, when the apostle John, who knew Jesus and was closer to Him than anybody else, when he sees the glorified Christ, he falls down in trembling and in fear. Revelation 19, I love this passage too, talks about Jesus when He comes back. Listen to these words. Then I saw heaven open, and here came a white horse. The one riding it was called Faithful and True. With justice, He judges and goes to war. His eyes are like a fiery flame, and there are many diadem crowns in His head. And He has a name written that no one knows except Himself. The idea is there's a part of His character that is incomprehensible that you and I just can't ever know. Part of the wonder of this worship is that we want to take a God who is incomprehensible and great, And we don't understand him. And that's why we worship him. He's bigger than we are. He understands more than we are. He is the creator, for goodness sake. Try to put that in a bottle. Try to put that in a box. You can't. And that's the whole reason for the prohibition. You can't put a transcendent God in the box. You ought not even try. Those are some good reasons why you ought not do that, some good reasons why the command is there. But there are also some probably sinful reasons of why we would want to try to do that. And probably the first one is that we would want to try to manage and understand God. Part of the reason why they built that idol in the first place is if you can see it and manage it and control it, well, it just works for our sinfulness. Again, Tozer has said this, left to ourselves, we tend to reduce God to manageable terms. We want to get him where we can use him, or at least know where he is when we need him. We want a God we can, in some measure, control. We need the feeling of security that comes from knowing what God is like. You see, to do that, to try to manage God in that way, is just to misunderstand our fundamental role that God has given to us in the very beginning. See, in the creation, God said, I'm in charge, and I will control you and manage you. You submit to me. But that's okay because he's given to man the control of the earth. We are to till it and to manage it and to oversee it. In turn, the earth is supposed to serve mankind, and it does that well when it's not under a curse, and man is supposed to serve God. When you try to take God and put him in a box, you try to manage and control him, what you've done is, you know, you've misunderstood the fundamental role. You don't manage God, you worship God. He manages us. You've also misunderstood the fundamental reality about our faith, because right now we serve an invisible God. We don't see him. Thomas did, and when Jesus came to Thomas, he said, Thomas, you know, it's good that you believe, but blessed are those who have not yet seen and yet believe. Someday our faith will become sight, but it's not right now. That's why the fundamental ground rules are, he that comes to God must believe that he is, and that he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. I suppose theologians may be some of those who are tempted to make idols out of God. You know, we don't do it with things we craft, but we sometimes do it with the way we think about God, because we're supposed to be in charge. We're supposed to know. Peter Craigie is a commentator in the book of Deuteronomy, one of the best. He puts it this way. He says, to construct by theological propositions a definition of the nature of God, and then to claim adequacy for that definition would be to construct an image as real as any wooden image. Sometimes theologians fall into that trap. Students ask us questions about God. We feel compelled sometimes to make up answers because we don't really know. Oh, yes, we understand him completely. Really? Maybe you ought to leave a little room for some shock and awe. Maybe leave a little room for a God who's just so much bigger than we are. The most important thing you can do is to understand what you can and then to bow down and worship. The original context of getting these Ten Commands was Sinai, where the mountain quaked and there was smoke and there was fire. And the people decided that was a pretty good idea right then, too. They just let God be God and worship him. It's too bad they forgot it soon after. There's some other concrete ways we do this, and I don't know exactly how to say it. I suppose when we worship the invisible God, we're sometimes tempted to become attached to the objects we use in worship. I don't know how else to say it than that. I don't want you to get the wrong idea. I love this building. I love this room. One of my favorite things in all the world is to come down here to this room early in the morning when nobody else is here and it's all dark and just meet with God. It just reminds me of him. It reminds me of you, the two most important things in God's universe, God and his people. But I don't need this place to worship. We could do it just as well in the gym. If a tornado came today and blew this place away, we could do it just as well in the gym. If a tornado came and blew the gym away, if it were a little more, you know, conducive outside, we could do it outside. Have a nice open-air meeting. God's or worship of God doesn't take place in a place. It takes place where God's people are. We don't need much of anything else, really. Somebody was upset that I wasn't using a pulpit, and they got in trouble for that. Said, what are we saying about the Bible if you don't use a pulpit? I wasn't really trying to say anything about the Bible or anything about the pulpit, except the pulpit's just furniture, really. I mean, if you really want to get serious about it, you can go back and take a look at Jesus. Did Jesus use a pulpit? No. In fact, you know, if you really want to play that game, I can get mean about that too. Because you read the Sermon on the Mount, it says, when Jesus went up to the mountain, his disciples came to him. That's when he sat down and began to teach them. What's the heart of worship? Heart of worship is when God's people get together with clean hands and a pure heart in order to lift up the name of God through song and the delivery of his word. There's really not much there about pulpits or pews or anything else that we often associate with our worship. I'm afraid sometimes we take the style of our worship and we make it a box in which we put God. You've got to really be careful that we don't try to canonize or make an idol out of how we do it. A couple years ago, I was put in a position where I was a little bit more in charge, more responsible for some of the majors in my department. So I said to myself, you know, I would like to know how they're worshiping and what they're doing on Sundays, because I've heard different names of churches, but I don't really know what they're like. So I made it a point in the summertime to go visit lots of different churches in the Miami Valley. I was amazed what I found. There's an amazing spectrum of the styles of worship. You would be blown away, like I was probably. There are a lot of churches that are very traditional. There are a lot of churches that are very contemporary. I mean, very contemporary. There are churches that are formal and churches that are informal. And what was interesting to me was I didn't find one particular version to be more authentic than the others. I found some that were traditional that people really seemed to be sincerely worshiping God. I found some that seemed fairly plastic. I went to some contemporary services where people were genuinely serving and celebrating God, and they were authentic. I went to some very contemporary services that seemed, again, to be a show and a performance. The difference didn't seem to be their style. And I think we need to be really, really careful as we tend to take a style and say, this is exactly the only way it can be done. Authentic worship, genuine worship, is when God's people get together with clean hands and pure hearts to lift up the name of God in song and in the delivery of his word. It's just so important for us to do that, because the only thing that the Scripture says about style, really, is in 1 Corinthians 9. Paul says this means I'm not bound to obey people, yet I've become a servant of everyone so that I can bring them to Christ. When I'm with the Jews, I become one of them so that I can bring them to Christ. When I'm with those who follow Jewish laws, I do the same, even though I'm not subject to the law, so that I can bring them to Christ. When I'm with the Gentiles who do not have the Jewish law, I fit in with them as much as I can. In this way, I gain their confidence and bring them to Christ. But I don't discard the law of God. I obey the law of Christ. When I am with those who are oppressed, I share their oppression so that I might bring them to Christ. Yes, I try to find common ground with everyone so that I might bring them to Christ. Paul's point here with style is, the only thing that style should do is allow you to be flexible enough to reach as many people as possible. So here's my question. I think the question that we ought to be asking ourselves is, do we, right here, represent a good cross-section of our community? Now, the group of people inside this building this morning, pretty representative of what you find when you go outside the building. And if we are, that's great. If we are not, what are we supposed to assume? That maybe God is only saving the kind of people who are just like us? Or is it because there's something about our worship that maybe ought to be flexible enough to invite and encourage and attract all kinds of people? The truth is that outcasts and beggars felt pretty comfortable around Jesus. I wonder if they'd feel the same comfort level around us. When we get to heaven, I have it on good authority that white middle-class American culture is not going to be the dominant one in heaven. That all nations are going to come together and worship in all different styles and forms. As long as God's people are together with clean hands and a pure heart in song, lifting up his name in the delivery of his word, we're going to have true worship, authentic worship. That's what we're here for. That's what we want to do. Those are some of the logical reasons why we don't want to make idols out of anything, least of all our styles here. Styles will be used in the delivery or in the means of reaching other people. But there are also some historical reasons for this command, and that was simply this, that the reason God gave the command was there were lots of other nations who would make idols and worship them. They came out of Egypt where there were lots and lots of idols, like the worship of the Nile and the worship of the sun and worship of the Pharaoh. They all had idols for those things. Where they went to was Canaan, where there were lots of different idols for Baal worship. He was the god of the storm, brought rain, and for farmers that means you brought crops and fertility and everything. A lot of different idols there. I wonder what kind of idols we have in our culture. What is it that our culture idolizes that we are to avoid? I suppose you could say we worship security by building up material things. We worship our own significance by building up our reputation instead of our character. All kind of ways we do that. Historical reference here, though, is make sure that you don't worship them or serve them. Now, that idea of worshiping and serving really goes together. Even Jesus uses those words together when he says, you shall worship the Lord your God only, and him only shalt thou serve. When we think of that word, probably worship is the center part of it. It's that corporate kind of worship where you actively lift up praise to God. But then it's also surrounded by the much larger idea of serving. Worshiping and serving. Worshiping is what we do when we get together corporately or sometimes individually. Serving is how we worship throughout the week. Not a bad way to think of it. Service is the Monday through Saturday kind of worship. Let's talk about the first one first here. Let's talk about corporate worship. What is corporate worship, and what should we be looking for? To have corporate worship work well, the people have to do what they're supposed to do. We have to come with clean hands and pure hearts. Sometimes we don't have that on our agenda. Sometimes our agendas look more like this. These are some questions we ask, and here are some questions God asks when we come together Sunday morning. We sometimes ask, what do people think of me? God says, I wonder what people think of me. We sometimes say, am I dressed correctly for church? And God says, what do you look like inside? We come along and say, will I be sufficiently entertained? God says, will you be changed and will you be challenged? We often think, will I find the crowd comfortable to be with? And God says, are you going outside your comfort zone to reach people? The people have to do their part and come with the right attitude. The preacher has to do his part and come with the right kind of message, the one that's intelligent but not just a lesson, that's heartwarming but not just heartwarming stories. And then it also has to involve our children. This is the thing I think that grabs me about this particular commandment. We have to do what's right, the preacher has to do what's right, but children are very directly involved. That's why it says, don't worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the fathers. You say, where does that come from? Here's where it comes from. Because children have to be involved in worship. If, in fact, our worship is not authentic, that gets passed down to generations, and they will pay for it. If our worship is authentic and genuine, that will get passed down and they'll be blessed because of it. Children have to be involved in the worship. They're involved no matter what. They better be involved in a good way. If the worship service is such that families can't reflectively discuss what happened during the day, we're in a lot of trouble. We visited some churches last summer and summer before, where we'd come home and say, well, now, what was that message about? And someone would say, I don't know. And I couldn't figure it out either. Did you? No, that's a sad thing. Give us pastors who wake up every morning and realize that the most important thing they will do that day is to prepare to feed and lead the flock in Sunday morning worship. Children have to be involved. They will be involved. I don't care if he can't administrate his way out of a paper bag. I want a pastor who leads us in worship, in intelligent worship. People are not starving for better organization. People are starving for someone to share with them every word that comes out of the mouth of God. Again, Tozer has said this. The heaviest obligation lying upon the Christian church today is to purify and elevate her concept of God until it is once more worthy of him and of her. In all of her prayers and labors, this should have first place. We do the greatest service to the next generation of Christians by passing on to them the undimmed and undiminished, that noble concept of God. It's interesting to me that in Deuteronomy chapter 12 and verse 31, this is the parallel passage to this commandment, it says this: don't follow these gods who require you to burn your sons and daughters in the fire for their God. Children are affected by worship for good or for ill. And that's why it seems to me that the kids ought to have a say in our next pastor. I'm not saying that they should have a vote, but I'm saying this, that moms and dads, you ought to talk with your kids. If kids say, I don't understand, I'm not sure what's going on, that's probably not a good sign. Because kids are important. Kids are affected by corporate worship. Let's talk about the wider sense, though, of worship, and that is service. You shall not worship them or serve them. This is the Monday through Saturday form of our worship. We know that because the words are used in Genesis 2:5. God says to Adam, I want you to serve. I want you to cultivate the ground. The idea is what you work at with your hands is the way you bring honor to me throughout the week. What I put my hands to becomes my worship on Monday through Saturday. I don't know if that's a hard concept for you to get your arms around or not, but I remember one of the first times I heard it, I remember Paul Mitchell talking about his story, and it was just such a sweet one and so accurate, I just have never forgotten it. He struggled for many years as he was in business for himself doing plumbing, thinking, I wonder if God is pleased with my service. I wonder if God is pleased. I wonder if I should be in something more spiritual. He said, then one day it hit me, it finally came to me that as I go out and work with my hands and I clean the sinks or work in the water tower, whatever I do, whatever I'm working at with my hands, these are my instruments of service to God. That the toolbox I have is my altar by which I worship. And he got it exactly right. Is that really spiritual? It doesn't seem so spiritual. It seems pretty physical. Yeah, it is absolutely spiritual. Because the opposite of spiritual isn't physical. The opposite of spiritual is selfish. And when you go out and you do that physical work with God in mind, that you're doing it for Him, it becomes the most spiritual thing you can think of. That's why a chapter later it says, take these words, take these commands, and bind them on your wrists, because I want you to know as you leave the corporate worship service that what you do with your hands ought to be done as an act of worship towards Him. What are you working at? What are you worshiping at? When you go to work on Monday morning, if you're going to push papers, or it's a blue collar or a white collar or a purple collar job, doesn't really matter. Are you going to have some time in the morning we say, God, whatever it is I do today, I want this to be done for your glory. I'm going to do this study, and I'm going to do these assignments. I'm going to do whatever this is for your glory so that you end up worshiping and serving Him in everything that you do. Colossians chapter 3 says this: you must put to death then the earthly desires at work in you, such as sexual immorality, indecency, lust, and evil passions, and greed. For greed is a form of idolatry. What you spend your life working and worshiping, what you invest your life in, is what gets almost genetically passed down to the next generations. The way we worship affects our children more than anything else we do. My dad helped me paint my way through college and seminary. One time a guy came along and paid us at the end of the job, and he gave us $600, $100 bills. He gave it to my dad and said, here, now you don't have to pay taxes on it. My dad didn't flinch. My dad said, no, we're going to pay tax on every penny. I don't know why the guy said that to my dad. I think he knew my dad would work for the Internal Revenue. I don't know. But maybe knowing that, he figured, you know, since he works for the Internal Revenue, he knows if a guy gives you cash, you really don't have to report that. Nobody would ever find out. But Dad didn't say we pay tax on every penny because he worked for the Internal Revenue. He said that because he worked for God. My dad and I never, ever did speak about that. I never asked him about it, never said anything to him. He never said anything to me. He didn't say that for my benefit. I was just there and I heard, and the message I got was, the work we're doing here is not to gain money. The work we're doing here is to honor God. The way you worship, the way you serve, Monday and Saturday and Sunday gets passed down almost genetically to our children. That's why our sins, if we are fake or if we are real, get passed down and they get blessed or cursed because of it, because they pick up what we are. And worship is the most significant place, the most significant thing that we pass on. There are also some personal reasons for this command, though, and I don't want to miss those. Because the passage says, I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. It may seem strange to you that God describes himself as a jealous God, but it doesn't seem strange to him because he does it over and over and over again. In fact, again, close to this passage, Exodus 34, God says, my name is jealous. You see, envy is when we want something that belongs to someone else. We want their position or their possessions. But jealousy is not that. Jealousy can be a very good thing. In fact, here, the Hebrew root portrays a very strong emotion, even a passionate desire. In this case, jealousy is an intense love, a high level of commitment that demands expression in a relationship which excludes all others. It's very, very personal. Do you remember what it was like when you had your first crush on someone else and perhaps it was returned, or you really weren't quite sure? And you had some feelings for this other person, but you didn't know if they felt the same way towards you. It was always kind of an interesting game to wonder, I wonder how they feel. And then a third party shows up, and you see a flash of jealousy, and you say to yourself, oh, this is good. Because the jealousy means they care for me. Do you understand the mind-blowing implications of this passage? That God is jealous for you? I love the implications of what this means. Last week when we talked about you shall have no other gods before you, we said it was a very rational choice. It only made sense since he's the creator of the universe, he ought to be the center of the universe, and it's absolutely rational. And then we come along here with command number two, don't have any idols because I'm a jealous God. It's almost as though God is saying, you know what? It is rational to put me there. It's also romantic to put me there. It's a very rational reason. It's also a very romantic reason because I'm desperately in love with you. I know it's hard for us to conceive of that, but it's absolutely true. Some of the times I try to share this with my students and I say, let's just take these first four commands and let's pretend, the book of Deuteronomy, that they weren't really written about God and us, that they were written about a guy and a girl. What if we translated them in terms for Joe and for Becky, okay? Joe and Becky get together, and Becky says, Joe, if we're going to have this relationship, here are some of the ground rules. And the first one was no other gods. How would you translate that? From Becky's perspective, it'd be pretty simple, wouldn't it? Joe, there's going to be no other girls. Pretty reasonable, isn't it? Yeah. No false images. What would it sound like to you? In a Joe and Becky relationship, probably no pictures of other girls, Joe. All those pictures of high school girlfriends, they got to go, Joe. There's no room for those. You shall not take my name in vain. That is, don't take me for granted. Don't use my name or use me or don't take me for granted. And keep the Sabbath holy. It's like, let's make some quality time for us. See, as you look at those first four commands, they're really pretty clear, aren't they? I mean, and if you said that to someone who was interested in beginning a relationship with you, but they wouldn't subscribe to those four rules, you'd say, you're not really serious. Anybody who really wanted a relationship, those are just natural and normal and credible. Those rules have relationship written all over them. And I hope as you take a look at what goes on here in Deuteronomy chapter 5, that you sense the heart of God coming through. I love the way he says it in chapter 5. Oh, that their hearts would be inclined to fear me and keep all my commands always, so that it might go well with them and their children forever. Oh, that they would respond correctly because I love them. It's even better here when you realize that a lot of the times, a lot of the reasons why we respond to others is out of our self-need. We're lonely, so we reach out. God's not lonely. God doesn't need us. He doesn't reach out because of loneliness. He reaches out because of love. Psalm 115, he says, here's what happens to people who serve idols. They serve idols, but the idols can't see them because they have no eyes. The idols can't hear them. The idols can't speak. The idols can't smell. And the worst thing is that those who worship them will become like them, dead. God says, enter into a relationship with me, love me, put me first place so that you can have the kind of life that I have. Psalm 24. Who may ascend into the hill of the Lord, or who may stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who has not lifted up his soul to an idol nor sworn deceitfully. Again, sometimes we think about the idols that we don't have any, but you know what? We need to be really careful about this. Because the very last words that Joshua said to his people in Joshua 24 were these. He says, I die and I move off the scene. I want you to know you've got to serve God and turn away from idols. And the people said, oh, we will serve God. And Joshua said, no, you didn't hear me. You've got to serve God and turn away from idols. And the people said, we will serve God. And Joshua said, wait a minute, you're not listening. You've got to serve God and turn away from idols. And the people said, we will serve God. And it wasn't so much what they did say as what they didn't say. What they didn't say was conspicuous by its silence. What they didn't say was, we will get rid of the idols, because it's the universal fallacy of mankind that we can serve God and we can serve other things as well. And the truth is, you can't do it. And the proof of that is the book of Judges that comes after the 24th chapter of Joshua. What we want to do is put God at the center of our universe. What we want to do is not lift up our souls to another. It's amazing, again, that God gives us that choice. That he leaves such an important thing to us. But again, God doesn't want forced love. Forced love is really an oxymoron, isn't it? There's nothing forced about love. It has to be a choice that you and I choose. As you look at what we've talked about in this last half hour, I just want to say one more thing before we leave, and that's this. It's only been about 30 minutes, and that's the same amount of time there is in a sitcom. Sometimes I think we think about sermons and sitcoms in the same way. There's an introduction, there's sort of a conflict, and there's a resolution, sort of a neat little package, and you leave it there, and then you go home. If that's all you think about this sermon, if you kind of liked it, you were entertained, you're ready to go, we've missed the whole point completely. The sermons are like fodder for your soul. It's like plowing up the ground and planting some seeds, and then what happens during the week is you've got to water them and cultivate it, and make it grow. What you and I have to do is to say to ourselves, if there are so many passages in the Bible, even in the New Testament, say, little children, keep yourselves from idols. We've got to say to ourselves, God, what are we doing where we're lifting up our hands to another? Lord, help us to know. Help us to see. We really want to put you first place. We're not content to worship you on Sunday morning and then serve something else, whether it's our own self-interest throughout the week. We want to serve you only. If you don't do that, then you're never going to enter into this community that's struggling to know God. That's what we're about here. We're not perfect. We're just struggling to know God and to put him first place in our lives. And we want you to be a part of that community. You've got to think about it hard during the week. You've got to talk with your children about it during the week. You've got to talk about it when you go out and when you come in. It has to be upon your hearts. It's not something you leave and think, oh, that was a nice show. The hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, because the Father seeks such to worship him. Will you be one of those? Will you join us, faltering, stumbling though we are, to seek to know this God and to worship him without anything else false in between us and him? That's our goal. I trust you'll join us in it. Let's pray together. Father, thank you for these words. Lord, we know that we don't live by bread alone, but by every word that comes out of your mouth. And these words were written for people 3,000 years ago. And they are very, very relevant for us today as well. Thank you that you're the kind of a God who not only is the rational choice, but the romantic choice. You not only deserve first place, but you love us and want us to have first place in your life. Father, thank you for this church. Thank you for the people who have come together to worship. I pray that as we leave, that we would serve and worship you in our service all week long. I pray it in Jesus' name.